Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with Professor Peter Chantler of the College's Department of Veterinary Basic Sciences about his research into the area of the cytoskeleton. Okay, Peter, thanks very much for joining us. Perhaps you could start just by explaining what the cytoskeleton is, please.
Yes, the term cytoskeleton refers to a space-filling framework found in every cell, and it gives that cell a particular shape or form. A framework's made up of filamentous protein polymers that are capable of self-assembly. In general, there are three types of filamentous cytoskeleton. Actin monomers polymerise to form microfilaments. At high magnification in the electron microscope, such filaments will appear as a double intertwined necklace. The second group, tubulin monomers, assemble into microtubules, and these appear as hollow tubules in the electron microscope that are about twice the diameter of microfilaments. The third group of cytoskeletal filaments are intermediate filaments, and these have a diameter in between the other two types, and they form strong rope-like structures. The exact arrangement of the filaments within a cell will vary. It'll vary according to the location, to the time of the cell cycle. For example, actin filaments may be arranged as a multidirectional cytoplasmic matrix in the body of the cytoplasm, or as parallel groups of filament bundles close to the plasma membrane.
Okay, so what are then the principal functions of the cytoskeleton?
Well, as the name implies, it does give form to the cell. But in addition to that skeletal responsibility, it is also required for cellular movement and for attachment of the cell to its surroundings, either to other cells or to the extracellular matrix. It can also provide a platform for the operation of housekeeping enzymes, such as the enzymes associated with glycolysis, the metabolism of glucose. But it's also directly associated with cell signaling, and at the points where the cytoskeleton meets junctional feet that allow the cell to sit on a substratum, those act as conduits for signaling too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the filaments that I've just described, of course, can't do all of this alone. They've got to do this as part of a three-dimensional network, and to make such a network, they must interact with a wide variety of other proteins, the cytoskeletal binding proteins. Of a special significance among these are the molecular motors. And these are protein engines that power motility at the molecular level, at the molecular scale, the nanoscale. And this brings about movement of the cell or cellular organelles. It should be noted that microtubules and microfilaments are not permanent structures, but they are constantly broken down and reformed so as to keep pace with the changing shape of the cell. And in this sense, of course, they're not skeletal in the usual way we use this term. And so I personally prefer to use the term cytoscaffold when referring to both the actin and the tubulin-based cytoskeletons, because this conveys the more dynamic character of their existence, the fact that they can be formed or dismantled as necessary. Other examples that may be less obvious are the movement of blood cells. Macrophages, for example, are white blood cells that move around the tissues by an amoeboid-like motion. In some parts of the body, red blood cells can push between other cells, cells that line the endothelium, and crawl through by a process known as diapedesis. In reality, all cells exhibit some form of movement, especially throughout development, but also into maturity. Individual animal cells are so large that organelles and vesicles packed with vital molecules need to be distributed, that is, moved, around the interior space of the cell. And indeed, these intracellular movements are extremely important in the nervous system, because neurons are elongate, asymmetric cells whose axons may extend many hundreds of centimeters from the cell body where they originate to reach their target. Many forms of movement, especially those that involve the whole cell, such as the crawling of macrophages or the extending of growth cones at the tip of those growing nerve processes, those require the cell to change its shape as it moves. And cells do so through restructuring of the cytoskeleton.
Okay, so how does this process occur then at the molecular level?
There are a number of distinct mechanisms that underpin cellular movement at the molecular level. Some do not involve molecular motors directly. For instance, at the front end of a moving cell, known as the lamellipodium, the membrane is able to move forwards through a mechanism that requires actin polymerization. Incidentally, this process was actually uncovered by very indirect means. Scientists were looking at bacteria such as Listeria, Shigella, or Rickettsii, and how they invade host cells in order to multiply and divide. Once inside the host cell, these bacteria move around by a propulsive mechanism. Each one looks like a miniature comet and has an assembly at its rear end known as a rocket tail.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the bacterium expresses a protein on its external surface that is able to commandeer the host cell's actin and convert the host's actin microfilaments into a form of bacterial propulsion through polymerization. The bacteria are able to move around the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Further work by others showed that similar proteins were present at the front end of eukaryotic cells and allowed actin assembly, known as nucleation, as well as polymerization, to occur with such force as to move the lamellipodium forwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are many other mechanisms, but these involve molecular motors. The motors are associated with microtubules, such as tubulin binding motors, and these comprise both the kinesin and dynein families of molecular motors. Or alternatively, there are motors associated with microfilaments, known as actin-based motors. And these comprise the myosin family of molecular motors. One way of thinking about this is, if you were to consider the filament to be a rail track, then each molecular motor is comparable to an engine that runs on a track, then you can think of these as being members of different companies that occasionally have to transport goods to the same destination but use their own private tracks to do so.
Right.
Many of those motors are actually unidirectional. In other words, they can move in one direction only, but some are capable of moving in both directions. Taking that analogy further, many of the molecular motors could interact with proteins that in turn attach to vesicles, rather like the carriages that are pulled by the train.
Mm-hmm.
And so these vesicles then contain vital materials, such as those required for plasma membrane construction, and alternatively the empty cargo carriages in the reverse direction could carry waste products.
Right.
Now that's particularly pertinent to the nerve growth cone, because at the growing tip of a nerve, during axonal outgrowth, actin-based motors are particularly important. In our recent work, we have focused on three closely related members of the myosin II families of molecules, 2A, 2B, and 2C. These molecules are forms of conventional myosin. That is, they have a shape that is very similar to the structure of myosins that have been known for over 50 years to power muscle contraction.
Mm-hmm.
Each molecule consists of two globular heads and a long extended tail. But the three types of molecule that we're looking at, 2A, 2B, and 2C, are actually distinct gene products in other words, different from those that the muscle produces.
Right.
And they're different from each other. Each has a separate gene. And those genes, indeed, are located on different chromosomes in most animals.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned that the types of myosins that you're studying are distinct from those in muscle, but is the sort of process that you're referring to the same in general terms which we're most familiar with in the context of skeletal muscle when we're talking about contraction, for example?
Yes, there are certainly similarities and there are key differences. Skeletal muscle cells are highly organized structures. They've evolved especially for repetitive contraction. Consequently, the assemblies of myosin molecules found there, known as thick filaments, are located in between regular near-crystalline parallel arrays of actin filaments, and they are able to interact with the actin in a cyclical manner. And this takes place through the heads of the myosin molecules.
Mm-hmm.
Myosin heads bind directly to the monomers, and during each of these interactions, the head will tilt relative to the elongated tail structure. And it does so while still remaining attached to the actin. And that, therefore, creates a force that drags the actin a distance of about 10 nanometers.
Mm-hmm.
The energy for that movement comes from the hydrolysis of ATP. Of course, myosin is an enzyme, and ATP hydrolysis takes place as an active site within the head of the molecule. After force generation has taken place, the myosin head separates from actin and re-cocks, ready for another cycle. Because this is happening for many myosin heads along the whole length of the thick filament, each of these operate independently from each other. And so there is swift detachment of one myosin head so as to prevent it interfering with the mechanism set in place, the motion set in place by all of the other heads.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, a smooth, relative sliding process can be achieved.
Okay.
But if we now turn our attention to what happens in non-muscle cells, and I'll use neurons as my example, there are similarities because the myosin II molecules hydrolyze ATP during interactions with actin that result in force generation, but there are also many differences as well. As we touched on before, the actin arrays in neurons are not necessarily organized, well-defined parallel arrays as you find in muscle, but they have a much more irregular three-dimensional feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
But an actin filament has directionality, and so productive force generation by the myosin heads will also be directional and dependent on actin orientation. There will be places where actin is organized as parallel bundles of filaments, just as in skeletal muscle, but there will also be places where this three-dimensional matrix is the main form of actin. Interestingly, bundles of actin filaments terminate at the cellular feet, these focal contact points that are responsible for the cell making adhesive interaction with the extracellular matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Application of tension at these points is vital for assessing the surroundings, whether it is just to sort of keep still, stasis, or to generate movement. Such regions are also major signaling conduits, and, for example, similar mechanisms may allow multipotent stem cells to sort of feel their surroundings and determine whether they're in a bony environment or in a soft, malleable environment, such as the brain, that in the first case would be useful for developing bone material, or in the second case, useful for making neurons.
Okay, so that's not only organising differentiation and development, but I guess it's occurring through a communication between cells as well as within cells using the same mechanism.
Yes.
Okay, so I know your interest is primarily in the subtypes of myosin that you've already mentioned, but what sort of techniques do you use then to study these proteins in the cell?
Over the past decade, we've developed an antisense knockdown approach to examine protein function. In general, there are several ways in which antisense knockdown can be achieved, but in our recent work, we used short stretches of DNA, sequences that were inverse complements to the coding sequences that encode each of the three myosin isoforms, 2A, 2B, and 2C. So in this way, we target each isoform specifically. For example, antisense sequence to myosin 2A is chosen so that it will bind to messenger RNA. Messenger RNA that only encodes myosin 2A. Not any of the other myosins, not anything else, just 2A. There are destructive enzymes in the cell that search and destroy RNA-DNA hybrids. Consequently, myosin 2A production in a cell will be curtailed because the message that would have ensured its production has been destroyed. Using this knockdown strategy in concert with high-resolution fluorescence imaging techniques such as confocal microscopy, we're able to determine whether or not our target protein has been knocked down. We do this with a complementary use of isoform-specific antibodies that have been labelled with fluorescent tags, and these can be seen in the confocal microscope. We also see how that knockdown has affected the distribution of other isoforms, as well as key parameters of cell morphology. And so there are several questions that stem from that. Do the cells remain adherent, for example? Do axonal processes continue to grow out? Do they retract? Does the cell body change in size or shape?
Okay, so obviously by removing one isoform at a time, you can then see the effect of losing one of these on the cell in each case and determine therefore its unique functions.
Yes.
So how then are these molecular motors actually important for function in the nervous system?
Well, during mammalian development, beginning in the embryo, nerves will grow out to reach their target. And some actually migrate to the location where they're going to produce axons. But as each animal grows, every nerve cell must grow with it. And this is because, unlike many other tissues where cell division is a key component of growth, most nerve cells do not divide. So if you can imagine a horse, once it has begun to grow, a single nerve, where it's a cell body based within the spinal cord, will have to develop an axon that grows virtually the whole length of one of the limbs.
Right.
So that's a considerable distance. Now, movement, which is effectively what has happened there, requires changes to the cytoscaffold and the activation of molecular motors. And we've shown that all three of the myosin isoforms, 2A, 2B, 2C, are critical for this movement to happen. Not only is that true during development, but it may continue to be true in maturity. Because for the majority of these nerve cells, the point of reaching a target is to make synaptic contact with that target. And roles for myosins may still continue in maturity at those synaptic connections. It's also important to realize that the nerve cell processes undergo movement within a three-dimensional environment. So all of the time, they're making contact with other cells or the extracellular matrix. Those contacts are important for adhesion of the cellular feet, but because those focal contacts are also signaling conduits, they're absolutely key to receiving guidance cues from the external world.
Right.
And basically, Those cues are signals that say to the cell, well, keep going, turn left here, go up a bit, go down a bit. And the molecular motors respond to these signals, these molecular guidance cues, and they will create, ultimately, a correctly wired neural circuitry in the body. The molecular motors must respond to these signals, the molecular guidance cues, in order to create a correctly wired circuit. It would not be much good, for example, if one's visual neural circuitry were linked directly to your elbow rather than to your brain.
Yes, indeed. I guess for the nervous system especially, these actions and movements have to be incredibly well controlled. So what are the different roles of the myosin isoforms in neurons, so 2A versus 2B, for example?
For a long time, there was a widely accepted view that closely similar gene products represented redundancy in the system. In other words, if one gene product was lost, then another gene would simply take over and produce something that would fulfill that role.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt there are some areas where this notion is true, but I've always doubted that that was the case for myosin, because you need at least the expression of three genes in order to produce an overall functional myosin molecule. The sequence differences that you get between the different isoforms ensure different rates of ATP hydrolysis in each of the cases. And they also have different mechanisms of regulation. So if you couple all of these biochemical differences with differences in isoform distribution, then the notion that one of these simply acts as a functional reserve for another seems very unlikely.
Mm.
Our work over the past decade has shown that each of the three isoforms, myosins 2A, 2B and 2C, has a distinctive yet related role to play in the determination of neuronal dynamics. In particular, whereas myosin 2A has been shown to be required for neuronal process retraction, both myosins 2B and 2C are required to drive neuronal outgrowth. Furthermore, the need for myosin 2 to generate tension at focal contacts during cell adhesion appears to require the actions of both myosins 2A and 2C. Yet myosin 2B has no role at all in this. Interestingly, others have shown that myosin 2B has a very slow ATP hydrolysis rate and remains attached to actin through a large part of its cycle. In other words, it would not be able to get out of the way quickly enough if it operated in a contractile system as found in muscle. This feature makes it much better suited to operate within a thixotropic three-dimensional matrix where the cytoplasm exhibits resistance to abrupt changes in applied force.
Okay, so what or how does the expression and function of these proteins then vary in other cell types?
The work that we've done and I've described here has been on neuronally derived cells. Each cell type in the body has a distinctive overall function, architecture, and cell cycle, and these ensure a characteristic set of expressed proteins at any one time. Furthermore, the arrangement of the actin cytoskeleton, as I mentioned before, determines the polarity of myosin motor operation. Consequently, although the concepts that we've unveiled for myosin motors within neurons are likely to be applicable in all cell types, the exact details may well differ. And an example of this comes from labs that have worked on endothelial cells. In these cells, myosin 2B appears to operate at the rear end of the cell, moving the rear end forwards, whereas myosin 2A is found towards the front of the cell and is involved in
forward motion. In many ways, that's actually an analogy for how the growth cone of the neuron operates, as opposed to the whole directionality of the neuron itself. But the exact mechanistic reasons for these differing arrangements are currently under investigation.
Okay. So are there any particular diseases then which arise from defects in the cytoskeleton which have been identified?
Well, yes, there are a number of different diseases that can arise from defects of the cytoskeleton, and as each year goes by, new information emerges as to new diseases that their causes had not been thought of before. For example, there is a rare inherited disease called progeria. It's a form of premature aging in humans. And this has now been shown to be due to a single mutation in one of the intermediate filament proteins, lamin. This protein underpins the nuclear membrane and was originally thought to have a structural role. It's now known that in addition to this structural role, lamins also provide attachment points for DNA during gene transcription. So in some way, this mutation alters the ability of the transcriptional apparatus to perform optimally. Now, unfortunately, many cytoskeletal proteins are so important that an animal cannot live without them. And we know this through knockout experiments, where an entire gene is removed from the genome of an animal and one observes the effects of the loss of that gene. And when this is done for some of the myosin isoforms, including the conventional ones that I've been talking about, one finds that early development show many abnormalities. And these abnormalities that are generated before birth, they very often lead to death on or before the day of birth.
Right.
Such knockouts are said to be lethal, and they testify to the importance of the role that has been lost as a result of that knockout process. So clearly, molecular motors and many elements of the cytoskeleton are critical to life itself.
Okay, well, I mean, that really serves to indicate, as you say, how important and fundamental these structures and mechanisms are for life. And indeed, it's been a pleasure listening to you explain all about them. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And I hope very much that you've enjoyed this latest edition of the podcast as well. As ever, if you've got any comments regarding content or format of these podcasts, please send us an email at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. And I very much hope that you'll join us again next time for the next edition. Thanks for listening.